When she was growing up in suburban Illinois, Robin Wisawati itched to get away from her ordinary life. While she was in college, she finally found that opportunity and went to Kenya to live with a Maasai family in a remote village. There she learned the language and the culture and found a new family and a new home. Today, Robin Wisawati serves as director of Free the Children's Kenya program, and she still lives part of the year in a remote area of Kenya. She describes her life-altering experiences in My Maasai Life, From Suburbia to Savannah. It's co-published by Me to We Books and Greystone Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings Robin Wisawati to our show today. Hello.
Good morning. I'm very happy to be here.
Of all the places in the world to choose from, why did you decide to go to Kenya?
Well, I was looking for something really different, and I thought Africa would be some of the most different scenery and people and culture and language and everything from the suburbs of Chicago. So it was actually a series of serendipitous events that a professor of mine at the University of Illinois, where I was getting my undergrad, had a professor, a colleague at the University of Minnesota, who had a colleague at the University of Nairobi in Kenya, who knew of a rural Maasai village who would welcome a visitor. And then the elders of that community sat down under a tree to determine which home I would move into. So it was kind of decided for me almost.
Well, often people go to these kinds of things when they join the Peace Corps, but you didn't take that route.
No, I was still getting my undergraduate degree, actually. And so even though I just finished 3 years of college, I didn't want to wait another year and sort of found my own route there.
And is this the equivalent of studying abroad?
It could be like a study abroad program, but a little bit more on my own.
So how much did you know about Kenya before you decided to visit?
I honestly didn't know very much at all. I went there a little bit selfishly and a little bit ignorant. I was looking more to run away from the life back in the Chicago suburbs that I didn't understand and feel at home with, and was looking to find something new. So for me in the beginning, it was more about what I was running away from than what I was running to.
And you went to Nairobi first, the capital city.
Yeah, when I was in Nairobi, I spent a couple of months there to take a couple half-hour lessons of Swahili, the language, and sort of get my bearings and my ground in the culture.
Is that what the Maasai speak, Swahili?
Well, the Maasai speak their tribal language called Ma, and then they also speak Swahili, which is the national language. And so it was a matter of learning either Swahili or learning Ma.
Now, Kenya used to be a British colony, and many people still speak English, but not in Maasai land?
There's some English in Maasai land. They start learning English around grade 4. And so someone's ability to speak English is also indicative of their education level. And not all of the Maasai, and not the majority of the Maasai, actually haven't had the chance to go through education. So to speak with the elders and the parent sort of generation, you have to learn either Swahili or Ma.
You didn't know much about Kenya, you say. How much did you know about the Maasai?
Well, I had barely heard of them before I moved into their home.
And that meant that you probably had a little sense of just what you were facing, because there are a lot of hardships in this book.
I remember when I first showed up at my new home, made out of mud and cow dung and sticks, in the middle of a savanna plain so dry with red soil and these flat-topped acacia trees and thorny bushes all over the place, I kind of asked myself, what am I getting into here?
Where did the Maasai live? They're one of the largest ethnic groups in Kenya, aren't they?
They are one of the 42 ethnic groups still there in Kenya, and they occupy much of the southwestern corner of the country and down into northern Tanzania as well.
And what do they do to survive?
Traditionally, they are pastoralists, meaning that they are nomadic and follow their herds and therefore make temporary housing out of mud and cow dung and sticks. But with sort of landlessness coming on and the encroachment of development, the culture is evolving and changing. They're becoming more permanent places, which means that they're changing their livelihoods from being cattle-based to actually being able to be small business-based. They're changing their housing. Instead of temporary structures, they're able to sort of build it up more. So there's a lot of changes going on in the Maasai culture.
And they've given up on the cattle? Who's producing cattle these days in Kenya?
Well, they are definitely, cattle is still at the heart of their culture. But the average size herd now, instead of being several hundred head of cattle, is a bit smaller. And that's due to their plots of land, although the Maasai still have a lot of land, especially compared to other ethnic groups within the country. But they're looking for alternative sources of income at the same time.
You were given a Maasai name almost immediately. Can you pronounce it for us?
Yes, my Maasai name that I was given is called Nasirian.
And what does it mean?
It means peaceful person, but to tell you the truth, I think I was just a little bit shy in the beginning, which I now try to live up to the name that they've given me in place of that.
And that was the reason that they wanted to come up with a name that kind of described you?
Yes, Maasai typically are given names off of their behavior.
And you needed a Maasai name? They just couldn't have been Robin?
They could have called me Robin. They actually recently, about a year ago, started calling me Robin after 7 years of living with them. But I'm very grateful. It's an indication that they were taking me into their family and their home.
There's an irony here. Your Maasai sister in this family named her baby after you, but she called it Robin.
Yes, and baby Robin is now 4.5 years old and not such a baby anymore. But
so can you describe a typical day?
Sure. We would wake up in the morning, and we'd wake up on our bed, which was like this mattress of tightly woven sticks resting about a foot off the ground. And my mama would speak to me in Swahili saying, Nasirian amka, sa ya kuenda maji, meaning Robin, get up. It's time to go fetch water. We, after fetching water and cooking breakfast, which was a cup of tea over the fire, and fetching more water to wash all the family's clothes by hand, fetching firewood to be able to do the cooking later over a fire, washing the family's clothes. The day-to-day life was basically made up of chores.
And you were living a typical Maasai woman's life.
Yes.
A man's life would have been very different?
Yes, men, their role is a bit different. Some men are employed, whether it's through teachers in the local community or a little bit further away, or going to market towns to be able to find job. They oftentimes are with the cattle. And so all day long, they'll herd, leaving at about 7 a.m. and come back a little bit after sunset with their cattle.
My guest is Robin Wizowaty. That's W-I-S-Z-O-W-A-T-Y. She's written a book called My Maasai Life. You became friends with a young man named Samuel, the son of one of your neighbors. How did you meet him?
He was a good friend of my family. He lived about a half a mile away, just near the homestead where I used to go and fetch water all the time. And so I knew.
Are the houses set that far apart?
Yeah, because they have a lot of land for their cattle. It's usually you can walk between 5 to 10 to 15 minutes between households. And Samuel was great friends with my family, and so he would come over after school. Because when I first met him, actually, even though he was 21 like I was, he was in sixth grade. Because as a child, he was a child laborer and didn't get to start first grade till he was 15. But he would come over after school and hang out with my household, and therefore we became quick friends.
Was that typical for somebody to be a child laborer, or did Samuel live a particularly difficult life?
Unfortunately, and not just Maasai, but many different ethnic groups within rural Kenya, education isn't as readily available as it is here. For some families, the nearest school is 20 miles away. Others, it's 10 miles away. And so some people aren't able to start going to even preschool until they're able to walk that distance in both directions every day. But since poverty is also, unfortunately, very rampant, young children are also often forced to be able to go to work instead of learn how to read and write at school.
Would the Maasai want that to be any different, or is this just something that grows out of their traditional way of living?
Well, the culture is very much evolving. And in my current development work now as the Kenya Program Director with Free the Children, we oftentimes sit underneath the trees, which are the meeting points for with the elders, who are the decision makers of the community. And when we ask them what their goal is that they want their children and their grandchildren and their community to aspire to, they always say the same thing. And that answer is always education.
At one point, you take Samuel to Nairobi, the biggest city he's ever been to. What was it like for him to experience the chaos of the city for the first time?
Samuel was awestruck in several different ways. I mean, he saw more cars than he ever thought existed in the entire world, heard more noise at one time than he had ever heard before, and saw more people than he'd ever seen in one place before. And
did he find that exciting or scary?
A little bit of both, to tell you the truth. The skyscrapers he thought were so tall that for sure they must fall on him at any second, and he was always planning his escape route. He said that the roads to cross were so big that he realized they had their own constitution and you could only cross at the zebra stripes. But he was a little astounded at the movie theater. He didn't like that very much.
He just insisted on leaving.
After about just 2 minutes.
Well, maybe it was just a bad movie. What was the movie?
It was one of those movies that opened with a scene of a car chase and guns shooting, and it was a little bit too much for him at the time.
Are most Maasai this removed from modern life?
It depends. Maasai land is, well, Maasai are one of the few ethnic groups within Kenya that have maintained their culture. The rest have been very open to westernization. So those communities on the outside of Maasai land are more westernized, and those on the interior are less westernized. And so you'll find some Maasai walking around in business suits and speaking English fluently and very educated and a little bit more similar to what we might be used to in even a city here like New York, whereas others get their first pair of shoes when they're 15 years old.
Well, that, I would assume that it meant for those, it means for those people that they're really not involved in the political life of Kenya. And Kenya's a country where politics is often in the news. So are they just totally excluded from that public debate?
All Kenyans are very politically active in terms of even very rural Maasai communities will get a paper. It might be a week late because they would have gotten it on a Saturday at market day.
Well, are they voting in national elections?
Absolutely. Kenya has one of the highest voter turnouts that I've ever experienced. And voter polling stations are set up in primary schools. And so anyone who's nearby a school is able to have the access to vote.
Mm-hmm. So that's one thing that where they do engage in national life. Because they seem to be living in a totally separate world on the whole.
Yeah. They, interestingly enough, were up to date on a lot of global politics, the big things. I mean, even after September 11th some years back, Maasai people had come together to say, we heard that this devastation occurred in America. What can we do? And they actually donated 15 cows to the American Embassy in Kenya after hearing of that world news.
Have radio, television?
Radio is very big amongst all of the herders walking around with their cows.
Mm-hmm. And what about cell phones?
Cell phones are all over Kenya. It's so interesting because you'll be in a field that you can witness, you know, the wind blowing the savanna grass, and it's a Maasai standing there in his red traditional outfit with all of these cows around. And then all of a sudden you'll hear an Alicia Keys ringtone and he pulls a cell phone out of his pocket.
You and Samuel grew very close. By the end of the book, the reader wonders if a future life with Samuel might be possible. You wonder the same thing. So what happened?
Well, Samuel and I have both realized that we want to be together for the rest of our lives, and in order to honor each other, then that role would be best served as friendship, and we will be best friends forever and ever.
Eventually, you moved out of your Maasai family's home to start your own home near the village. Is that part of the growing up process?
It was part of my growing up process. I wanted to feel, I mean, I was treated as a daughter and I played the role as a daughter. And I kind of wanted to feel like what it would be to be my own mama. Like, what is it to have full control, like to know how much water you have left in your jerry can in order to finish washing all the clothes, to know how many tomatoes you have to make it till the next market day of Saturday. And it was a wonderful challenge that I made a lot of mistakes and mama would come and correct me on a lot of things, but it was a really growing challenge for me.
You also built your own Maasai home.
Yes, together with my Maasai grandma and the rest of the women of the community, I was able to live in a mud and cow dung and stick home built for me.
My guest is Robin Wissapati, whose book, My Maasai Life from Suburbia to Savannah, is published, co-published by Me to We Books and Greystone Books. There are other people in the world who live in remote regions like the Maasai do. Do you think that you would have had a similar experience no matter where you went?
It could be that way. I think that for me, what really made this experience all that it was my family members and the community members. It was really the people, more so than the scenery or the culture, but it was their generosity and their values that they lived and took me in so fully that I fell in love with and that they fell in love with me.
Well, you went for a limited time and wound up staying a lot longer. But you talked about their values. One of the most vivid episodes you describe in the book is the circumcision ceremony of your Maasai sister. Clitoridectomy is something that Westerners have a real problem accepting.
Yes, I remember when my mama first said, Nasarian, do you want to come and support a girl as she gets circumcised? And to tell you the truth, I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know what it meant to circumcise a girl, and I didn't know what it meant to support her. But she asked me with such a pride and excitement in her voice. And this was the woman who had tenderly taught me so much for the last few months. And so I hesitantly said, yes, I would like to go. And I didn't realize that to support it meant that I would visually be a part of watching the process. And I remember that in that first moment of being such a part of the ceremony, all I could do was kind of bite onto my finger that I'm sure probably still has a scar if I find it. And in the weeks that followed, I was able to talk to elders and young people, educated and uneducated, about why they do the practice.
Well, there are people who are changing, trying to change that attitude in Africa. In fact, there's a great film called Mulade by Ousmane Sembène, probably the greatest filmmaker to come out of Africa, in which women, some women rebel. Other women insist on maintaining the tradition.
Yeah, and I found that the reasons for those to rebel and those who were for the practice were quite divided by age group. Those who were older really didn't want the culture to stop at their hands, and those who were younger had been to school and learned about the health implications of such a decision. So what the community is looking for as a whole right now is a way to honor the tradition and the health implications by starting what's called an alternative rite of passage.
I've been reading about a drought in this area, in much of northern Africa. How affected are the Maasai?
Unfortunately, Maasai live in very dry areas. And in times of drought, it affects their safety, as their springs will dry up during the day and they have to go and fetch water at night, evading hyenas. Or it affects their decisions such as, you know, this week, am I going to let my kids take a bath or wash their clothes or save the water so that they have some water to boil their corn in so they can continue eating. And unfortunately, drought affects their safety and sanitation and nutrition.
The effectiveness of relief efforts has been the subject of a lot of debate, and you witnessed some attempts. What is your general take on it?
I think there's two parts to it. One is immediate relief in times where there's no food, then for food to be provided through lunch programs. So it's for kids who are going to school, and that is very helpful to get through those times. But the more important and long-term and sustainable option is to have development work, that you can work together with the communities, empowering them to be a part of the development process to ensure that there are long-term water systems, whether it's drilling wells, harvesting rain catchment systems, and having the education in place to understand the importance of it.
Part of the problem in many of these projects is that they're Western inspired and they don't really fit in with the culture. How do you get past that?
I think that that's a great point. And one thing that makes Free the Children, the organization I'm with, so unique is because we believe in partnership and ownership of the project by the community, working only in communities that individually invite us into the process and starting out with what their vision is. And again, their vision is education, but in order to make education sustainable, affecting water so that girls can also get the chance to go to school.
A listener wonders if they're politically active, do they vote as a bloc?
Interestingly enough, that's a great question. They oftentimes listen to their local leadership as to who to vote, because it's not always the most educated vote, and they're not voting on a platform. They're usually voting in terms of to support their local leader and their local leader's political opinions.
Are they part of the majority party?
They are. Sometimes they listen to their church leaders, which was against a local referendum in the Constitution that just took place on August 4th. And then for the political election, they were with the majority.
So then you went back to Illinois. You'd had a culture shock when you arrived in Kenya. Another culture shock when you returned home?
Coming back to Chicago was actually the biggest culture shock of the entire process, because, you know, I was coming to my hometown where I expected to feel so familiar with everything, but all of a sudden I kind of felt like the foreigner. And it wasn't because the dichotomy exists. I mean, I knew that I was going from a place that we were walking barefoot without electricity and running water and going to a place where grocery stores are full and wide lane highways and all of that. But what I wasn't prepared for was the thoughts that would come along with that. And what I've learned throughout my years, I mean, I've made a lot of mistakes and how to handle that, varying on the different extremes. But what I've realized is this dichotomy shows us there's so much potential for ensuring that other people have enough.
I mentioned that you are the director of Free the Children's Kenya program. So you came back and you joined an NGO?
Yes, I realized that while I came back to Chicago and appreciated all of the amenities and rights that I could enjoy, that appreciation for me wasn't quite enough, that I needed to do something about it. And that's when I first heard of the organization called Free the Children. Mm-hmm. It's a Canadian-based organization started about 16 years ago by a 12-year-old boy named Craig Kielberger, who, when he first heard that there are children working nowadays instead of being able to go to school in this concept of child labor, he was so angered by this that he challenged his seventh grade class to start a club to do something about it. And Free the Children went from a small after-school club to the world's largest network of children helping children through education.
Kenya has had very corrupt governments over the years. How do you get past that when you're doing this kind of aid? And you got to tell me it in 10 seconds.
We work mostly with the local authorities so that we can ensure that the work gets done on the ground opposed to getting lost in the national level.
Robin Wizowaty, Wizowaty. Her book, My Maasai Life, From Suburbia to Savannah. And you're not talking about Savannah, Georgia here. You're talking about the savannas of sub-Saharan Africa. The book is published by Me to We Books and Greystone Books. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
On tomorrow's show, we'll discuss the new field of fetal origins, which looks into how much our health, our intelligence, and our temperaments are influenced by the conditions we encountered in utero. Then James Taffy Wright talks about being a roadie and tour manager for some of the world's greatest music stars. Also, find out what's contained in the recently discovered three boxes of photos from the Spanish Civil War by photographers like Robert Capa and others. Plus, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Isabel Wilkerson chronicles one of the great untold stories of American history, the decades-long migration of black citizens who left the South for northern and western cities. The Letter to the Page Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and with help today from Adi Braun, Carrie Barber, Dan Volpe, and Sasha von Olderhausen. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.